from deep inside your radio.
And from the historic Le Chaux Dome. And because it's historic, they've torn it down. Because that's the L.A. way. Ladies and gentlemen, the United States Army Corps of Engineers. You've heard a lot about them if you've been listening to this broadcast for any length of time. You'll hear a lot about them in the forthcoming documentary film by the host of this program called, well, the film is called The Big Uneasy. But really, what's the Corps of Engineers up to now? Well, sir, a plan by them to use coal ash to fortify flood protection levees on both sides of the Mississippi River is being debated in St. Louis. Environmental groups oppose the plan, you know, like environmental groups always oppose the plans of the Army Corps. The ash is known as fly ash. It is the residue of coal combustion at power plants. It contains, your average toxins, arsenic and mercury. And it has been closely linked to cancer. So why wouldn't you use it to line a waterway? Kathy Andrea, president of the unfortunately named American Bottoms Conservancy. I don't name them. I just read them. The American Bottoms Conservancy says coal ash is highly unstable and degrades in the presence of water, making it a bad choice for levee construction. So bottoms down to that. But in an environmental assessment issued in May, the Corps determines that the mixture of lime and coal ash it plans to inject into the levees is both safe and cost-effective. The Corps wants to use the mixture to reinforce levee embankments in Missouri and Illinois over a 200-mile stretch of the river between Alton and Gale. You know where that is. It's near Alton. And in Los Angeles, how does the Corps deal with dissent? Subject tackled in The Big Uneasy. But here we have an example in Los Angeles. Heather Wiley was a 29-year-old biologist with the Corps of Engineers. What's a biologist doing in the Corps of Engineers, first of all? She lost her job because she commandeered the shallow waters of the Los Angeles River in a kayak to prove that the Los Angeles River was a navigable waterway. And last week, the EPA ruled it traditional navigable waters, entitled to the protections of the Clean Water Act, a huge victory for the activists who've worked for decades to protect the river from developers and polluters. Without Wiley and that boat trip, which defied the law at the time, might not have happened. The EPA cited the boat trip as proof the river is navigable. But it was something that the Corps of Engineers opposed. Corps found two internet images of her on the river. They threatened to suspend her for 30 days, saying the expedition, quote, undermined the Corps' authority, unquote. I got treated as some kind of disloyal traitor, she told the LA Times. Are they still putting that out on paper? They killing trees to do that? Her leaked documents about the boat trip reached Congressman Henry Waxman, and the EPA invoked its authority to supplant the Corps as the agency that would determine whether the LA River was protected under the Clean Air Act. So thanks, Corps of Engineers, for trying to stop that. Meanwhile, ladies and gentlemen, the story of formaldehyde in your life continues. The California Air Resources Board has granted a one-year extension of sell-through dates to give retailers another year to clear their inventories of furniture and other stuff that doesn't comply with the state's strict new formaldehyde emission standards. In other words, retailers have one more year to sell you the stuff that can fill your life with formaldehyde. The standards affect composite panel, a commonly used product in wood furniture and upholstery frames. So buy up your wood furniture and upholstery frames now and breathe in, breathe deep. Composite panels, not to be confused with death panels, unless you breathe in deep. And, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brain on the war on drugs. Grenades made in the United States and sent to Central America during the Cold War, you know, for our aid to the right-wing governments in Guatemala and Nicaragua, and Panama. Those grenades have now resurfaced as new weapons in almost weekly attacks by Mexican drug cartels. See how it goes? Sent a generation ago to battle communist revolutionaries in the jungles of Central America, U.S. grenades are being diverted from dusty old armories and sold to criminal mafias who are using them to destabilize the Mexican government and terrorize civilians. That's according to U.S. and Mexican law enforcement officials. The redeployment of U.S.-made grenades by Mexican drug lords underscores the increasingly intertwined nature of the conflict. The gangs also have brand-new military-style assault rifles purchased in the United States and munitions from the other side in the Cold War, too. So, spreading joy wherever we go, ladies and gentlemen. Hello. Welcome to the show.
You got a face that beckons commuters on every subway. A pair of eyes that Leo da Vinci would love to draw. The kind of lips that hardly anyone was actually born. The kind of body that doesn't have a single flaw. Now that you've risen to glory on your camera-friendly cheekbones, you don't get into makeup for less than 20 G's, maybe 30. You're quite impossible to flatter. That's right, it really doesn't matter. You smile and half the world is on its knees. Now why is that? 'Cause you're a little too good-looking. A little too good looking. When they handed out the jeans, you shouted bingo. Because your parts all work together. They all work together with the synergy of John Paul, George, and Ringo. You can't relate. You make little jokes about the weight of us normal folks. You might be slightly out of. Touch is true. Wouldn't be if they were you. You could be just a little too good looking. On TV you proselytize, but your own brand of exercise. How I crave the dynamism of your fast metabolism. You're here, you're there, you're everywhere. You're like a constant fever dream. My friend saw you uptown, swore up and down. You were flawless as you seem. Opportunity to write a single postcard. You got the notice of an Oscar de la Renta suit. Before you knew it, you were parading down the catwalk. Done up in almost nothing but look up your disdain. You know the men will want to meet you, although they're only going to treat you as if you simply couldn't have a brain. You're a little too good looking, a little too good looking, with the closet twice the size of Colorado. Because you cultivate your beauty, it's a sacred duty. Late at night you smear your bod with avocado. Front cover news, you're staying mighty hot, high level schmooze. Parlay what you got into what you choose. There's gonna be a day, it all slips like. God knows how much you took in. Just because you're so good looking, guess you can't be too good. If they asked you, you could write a book about how good you look.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. Kissed by sea breezes, ladies and gentlemen, for your listening pleasure. And now, It's time for me to read the trades for you. First, from Advertising Age, the Bhagavad Gita of the advertising industry. How LeBron's entourage got his decision on ESPN. Oh, yeah, I'll read it for you. That's why I'm here. By now you've heard the offense against basketball star LeBron James' one-hour TV special to announce his team choice, that it was narcissistic, sullied his brand, and blurred the journalistic line for ESPN. But what you haven't heard is the defense of the man who helped put the show together, Uber agent Ari Emanuel, who says the decision forwarded the paradigm for advertiser programming. In an exclusive interview with Advertising Age, Emanuel helped fill in some of the gaps on the backstory of how the program came together and addressed the naysayers. Everybody can say what they want. It was the wrong decision. There was too much hoopla, whatever. But for me, it was about doing the event, getting the advertisers to participate, and doing it for charity, Mr. Emanuel said. This was a major success for advertisers, and we're getting closer to pushing the needle on advertiser content programming. Emanuel said all sponsors who were approached had the choice to advertise on the program or contribute, and did not comment further. ESPN donated the block of time and agreed the ad revenue would be donated to charity. All told, the program generated $6 million in ad revenue. The eight brands featured in the show received $2.9 million in equivalent ad time. The show began when Emanuel was sitting with media mogul David Geffen at an NBA Finals game in Los Angeles and was approached by LeBron James business manager Maverick Carter. The group talked about how best to announce James' team choice and settled on the concept of a TV show. Emanuel looped in William Morris partner Mark Dowley. He and Maverick Carter began contacting advertisers and looking for a home for a show with the idea that the proceeds from ad revenue would go to charity. Originally, discussions were with ESPN's Walt Disney Company sibling, ABC, but a date could not be found. The plan was then to have James make his announcement in a special on ESPN prior to the network's annual award show. He would then walk on stage during the live telecast and present the night's first award. But Emanuel and other executives indicated that the way NBA's free agency was structured made it not suitable to wait until July 14th. Not to mention, the media cycle would make it difficult to keep a lid on the news. Once July 8th was chosen as the date, all ESPN exec VP John Skipper had to do was clear the space. But even that wasn't quite so easy once the network began receiving backlash about blurring the journalistic line. John Skipper and I had a long, long conversation about this, Emanuel said. We went through everything. Emanuel did not discuss the possible Hollywood brouhaha over the fact that he and William Morris helped broker the deal when LeBron James is a client of rival CAA. So thank Ari Emanuel, ladies and gentlemen. I know I do every day. And this from Australia. Skincare group Vaseline has reignited debate over the issue of skin lightening in India, with an internet application released in India that lets social networkers make their profile pictures appear paler. The skin lightening industry has been estimated around $172 million in India. Human rights campaigners argue that advertisements for such products reinforce age-old prejudices that skin color determines future success. In 2009, a poll of nearly 12,000 people revealed that skin tone was considered the most important criterion when choosing a partner in three Indian states. More and more, there's an anxiety in the mind of men about having fair skin, says a sociology professor at Nehru University. The Vaseline widget promises to, quote, transform your face on Facebook with Vaseline men. In a campaign fronted by Bollywood actor Shahid Kapoor, who is depicted with his face divided into dark and fair halves. The app was created to promote its new skin lightening cream. Half a dozen foreign brands have piled into the male skin lightening market in India, including L'Oreal and Nivea, which promote the seemingly magical lightening qualities of their products in ubiquitous advertising. Indian cosmetics giant Emami launched the first skin whitening cream for men way back in 2005 called Fair and Handsome. It came 27 years after the first such cream for women. See, that's not right. Indians believe that if you have fair skin, you belong to the higher caste, the Brahmins, says the sociologist. Pankaj Parihar, from the advertising firm Omnicom, which designed the campaign, the response has been pretty phenomenal. Lighten your skin on Facebook. Just another modern marvel you wouldn't know about had I not read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Thanks to Ari Emanuel for that, too. Just thinking about it makes my skin lighter. Ladies and gentlemen, I've just returned from New Orleans, Louisiana, and a lot of people are still curious about the former mayor. And well, they should be. I mentioned a few weeks ago from New Orleans that the mayor does have his lasting legacy in physical terms, the collapsed concrete grand entrance to Louis Armstrong Park. News came last week that the construction firm he had given the contract to redesign the park and add some new statues in addition to Louis Armstrong, some other jazz heroes. That company, headed by a gentleman convicted of a felony for bribing a school board member. But hey, that company now is off the job. One of their last efforts, in addition to setting and having to dig up the concrete three different times, because it, you know, concrete, not easy to. They apparently broke the statue of Louis Armstrong in Armstrong Park. But what else is Ray Nagin doing now? Well, he's opened a consulting business. And even though visits to his 26th-floor office by a reporter for the Times-Picayune found the door locked, a phone number not listed on the electronic directory in the lobby. But the services he offers, in case you're interested, ladies and gentlemen, political consulting, public speaking, how to you know, make a splash with your own Chocolate City comment, internet communication, radio, TV, and movie development, and, most important, disaster recovery advice. So if you don't think you're getting good enough disaster recovery advice from former FEMA director Mike Brown, call Ray Nagin. And he'll be Ray Nagin on you. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Further adding to the evidence that BP might, in fact, be a British company, this from the Financial Times. David Cameron this week will defend BP on a two-day visit to Washington, insisting the company must have a stable and strong future for the sake of the UK economy and the pensioners who rely on its dividends. BP is concerned that the pressure from U.S. politicians, which have accelerated this week with allegations over the company's role in the release of the convicted Lockerbie bomber, BP concerned that the pressure could cripple the company, leaving it vulnerable to a bid from ExxonMobil. We wouldn't want that. That's a U.S. company. Carl Hendrik Svanberg, BP's chairman, met Prime Minister Cameron on Friday to urge him to help counter the attacks being directed against BP from Capitol Hill. Cameron told Svanberg he did not want to inflame the row, but he would deliver a firm reminder to Barack Obama and congressional leaders of the importance of BP to the UK economy. In another move to support BP, Sir Nigel Sheinwald, UK ambassador to Washington, rejected the accusation by some U.S. senators that BP had lobbied the U.K. government to release convicted Lockerbie bomber al-Megrahi from jail in an attempt to win new contracts in Libya. Sir Nigel said inaccuracies were, quote, harmful to the U.K. BP has acknowledged it did lobby the U.K. government to speed up a prisoner transfer agreement with Libya. I guess I know what the B stands for. And from the Observer, BP ordered the owner of the Deepwater Horizon rig, whose explosion led to the oil in the Gulf, to overhaul a crucial piece of the rig's safety equipment in China. The blowout preventer, the last line of defense against an out-of-control well, subsequently failed to activate and is at the center of investigations into what caused the disaster. Experts say that the practice of having such engineering work carried out in China rather than the U.S. saves money and is common in the industry. There is no evidence that the significant modifications to the blowout preventer, which were carried out in China in 2005, caused the equipment to fail, but industry lawyers said BP could be made liable for any mistakes that a Chinese subcontractor made carrying out the work. It's almost impossible to secure damages in China, where international law is barely recognized. International law, you know, like the conservatives deride. It's understood the lawyers for the manufacturer of the blowout preventer will argue the device was so significantly modified in China that it no longer resembled the original component, and that manufacturer, Cameron International, should not be held liable. Transocean, the owner of the rig which bought the blowout preventer from Cameron, has already told congressional hearings that the modifications were carried out at BP's request and under its direction. So, there you go. Where the tainted dog food comes from, that's where you should send your blowout preventers, ladies and gentlemen, for servicing, because that's what the oil companies do. News from outside the bubble. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. It is clean. It's safe. It's cheap. Too cheap to be safe. Too safe to meter. Some of all that. It's nuclear power. Deadline Washington, the amount of plutonium buried at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State is just 3 times what the federal government previously reported. So a new analysis indicates that a cleanup to protect future generations from the plutonium, didn't they used to call it the single most dangerous substance on the planet? Yes, they did. Thank you. That cleanup will be far more challenging than planners had assumed. Plutonium waste is much more prevalent around nuclear weapon sites nationwide, not just at Hanford, than the Energy Department's official accounting indicates. This is according to Robert Alvarez, a former Energy Department official who in recent months reanalyzed studies conducted by the department in the last 15 years. The problem is most severe at Hanford in south-central Washington. By the time production stopped in the 1980s, Hanford had made most of the nation's plutonium. Your center for plutonium. It doesn't pose a major radiation hazard now, so forget about it, because it is under institutional controls like guards, weapons, and gates. Well, nobody will be cutting back the budget for guards, will they? Government scientists say even in minute particles, plutonium can cause cancer because it takes only 24,000 years to lose half its radioactivity. It's certain to last longer than the controls. You guards are going to stay there, right? Oh, you got lunch? Okay. The fear is that in a few hundred years, the plutonium could reach an underground area called the saturated zone. Sounds like a new nightclub at the LA Live, where water flows and from there enter the Columbia River. Columbia gem of the rivers. Because the area is now arid, contaminants move extremely slowly, but over the millennia, the climate is expected to change, according to experts. The cleanup will be more complex, perhaps requiring technologies that do not yet exist. More than 20 years after the Energy Department vowed to embark on a cleanup, it has still not characterized or determined the exact nature of the contaminated soil. Government officials recognize they still have a weak grasp of how much plutonium is contaminating the environment. The numbers are changing, says a radiation expert at the Washington State Department of Ecology. Well, who isn't changing? You know, it's a dynamic universe. Ladies and gentlemen, the European banks are now undergoing their own stress tests. You remember those? We had them in this country about a year ago, last spring, to try to determine if the banks can withstand another little thing. The question has become central in the debate about how to reform the global financial system. And congratulations to the United States Congress for passing financial regulation reform. Now, as I remember, the key problems that were highlighted at the time that things went bluey were toxic assets on the books of the banks, which nobody could value. So banks didn't know what they had, and the value was plummeting. So the proposal was made at that time, let's skim those toxic assets off the books of the banks and put them in a separate bank, a so-called bad bank, and then the so-called good banks could recover more quickly. That never happened. But what did happen was that the big banks, the ones that were too big to fail, were encouraged by the federal government to take over the weaker banks, and so they got bigger. The two things not addressed in the financial regulatory reform bill passed by Congress, toxic assets and banks that are too big to fail. Anyway, next week, European regulators will announce the results of the tests on the 91 European banks designed to see how they'd respond to another round of economic shock. The results could well show that European banks need tens of billion dollars in help. That could dim growth and force banks and their host governments to present a clear plan for paying the tab. Europe's banks have not raised as much new capital as U.S. firms since the crisis. They've been slower to write off bad loans and have been entangled in local and regional problems whose overall impact remains unclear. The International Monetary Fund has criticized European banks' reliance on government funding, delaying an inevitable reckoning. Maybe it's finally time to sing the praises of the bad bank. Losing Interest Weekly. This is Le Show. And just on the one more thing on the subject of the financial regulatory reform passed by Congress. Congratulations, you guys. Really, man. New York Times reported on Friday. Hey, it's Sunday. New York Times reported on Friday that most of the new regulations that affect banks that will not allow them, for example, to charge as much as many fees on debit cards and other kinds of restrictions on their fees will be banks have already figured out that they'll just charge more somewhere else, like goodbye to free checking. So that's really going to hurt. They're saying customers are going to pay for most of this. Now, if they'd broken up the too big to... Oh, who knows? Who knows what could have happened then? But now, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Yes, we can. Oh. A new study concludes that an old, fundamental, and widely accepted theory of how and why phytoplankton bloom in the oceans is incorrect. The findings challenge more than 50 years of conventional wisdom about the growth of phytoplankton. They're just the ultimate basis for almost all ocean life and fisheries. And they also raise concerns that global warming, rather than stimulating ocean productivity, may actually curtail it in some places. The analysis was published in the journal Ecology by Michael Barenfield at Oregon State, one of the world's leading experts in the use of remote sensing technology to examine ocean productivity. It concludes that a theory first developed in 1953 called the critical depth hypothesis offers an incomplete and inaccurate explanation for summer phytoplankton blooms observed since the 1800s in the North Atlantic. These blooms provide the basis for one of the world's most productive fisheries. The old theory made common sense and seemed to explain what people were seeing, Barenfeld said. It was based on the best science and data available at the time, most of which was obtained during the calmer seasons of late spring and early summer. But now we have satellite remote sensing technology providing us with much more comprehensive view of the oceans on literally a daily basis. And they strongly contradict the critical depth hypothesis. That was that phytoplankton bloom in temperate oceans in the spring because of improving light conditions, longer and brighter days, and warming of the surface layer. Warm water is less dense than cold. There's a problem. A 9-year analysis of satellite records of chlorophyll and carbon data indicate this long-held hypothesis is not true. The rate of phytoplankton accumulation actually begins to surge during the middle of winter, the coldest, darkest time of year. Figure out the consequences yourself. On your own nickel. In a pioneering use of CT scans, scientists at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution have discovered the carbon dioxide-induced global warming is in the process of killing off a major coral species in the Red Sea. Why do we care what happens in a communist ocean? I don't understand. As summer sea surface temperatures have remained about 1.5 degrees Celsius above ambient over the last 10 years, growth of the coral has declined by 30% and could cease growing altogether by 2070 or sooner, they report in the July 16th issue of the journal Science. The warming in the Red Sea and the resultant decline in the health of this coral is a clear regional impact of global warming, says Neil Cantlin at the Woods Hole Institution. A new report attempts to quantify the impacts from climate change by looking at very... That's a little dense, even for me. Last month was the hottest June ever recorded worldwide, and the fourth consecutive month that the combined global land and sea temperature records have been broken, according to the U.S. government's Climate Data Center. 2010 is now on course to be the warmest year since records began in 1880. The trend to a warmer world is incontrovertible. According to NOAA, June was the 304th consecutive month with a combined global land and surface temperature above the average of the 20th century. The last month with below average temperatures was February 1985. There were temperature anomalies. Spain experienced its coolest June since 1997. And Guizhou in southern China, Gesundheit in southern China, which had the coolest June on record. In a further sign of a warming world, the extent of sea ice in the Arctic was at its lowest for any June since satellite records started in 1979, and the Jakobshavn Isbray Glacier, sorry about that, I apologize to you, the glacier. I'm apologizing to a glacier on the radio. One of the largest in Greenland lost a 7 square kilometer chunk of ice between July 6th and 7th, one of the largest single losses to a glacier ever recorded. And from the proceedings of the National Academy of Science, although preliminary estimates from published literature and expert surveys suggest striking agreement among climate scientists on the tenets of anthropogenic man-caused climate change, the American public expresses substantial doubt about both the cause and the level of scientific agreement. A broad analysis of the climate scientist community itself, the distribution of credibility of dissenting researchers relative to agreeing researchers, and the level of agreement among top climate experts has not been conducted and would inform future discussions. Now, in a publication in the proceedings, they use an extensive data set of 1,300 climate researchers and their publication and citation data to show that 97 to 98% of the climate researchers most actively publishing in the field support the tenets of anthropogenic climate change, and the relative climate expertise and scientific prominence of the researchers unconvinced of it are substantially below that of the convinced researchers. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Let's get a little tabloid, shall we? I imagine most of you are aware, especially since there was a negative mail received by All Things Considered when they did a story on this. So even those of you who don't want to be aware are aware that some tapes have surfaced of telephone conversations between Mel Gibson and his current girlfriend, or once current girlfriend, Oksana. I don't remember her last name, because that's how I roll. And the tapes reveal kind of a, I don't know, petty, angry, disturbing relationship. They don't provide the whole story, however. There have been much more serious conversations between the two. And fortunately, we've gotten our hands on a partial tape of one of those.
You freaking think our insurgency makes one freaking shred of sense?
I think General Petraeus has a chance of making it work.
What? What?
General Petraeus wrote the book on counterinsurgency tactics.
I'll tell you what book he wrote. He wrote the book on being an a-hole! A freaking a-hole! That's the book he wrote. How dare you tell me he wrote the book?
He wrote a manual on counterinsurgency.
The only counter you should be talking about is the one you're working behind when you're not giving me freaking lip service!
My point is simply we should give his strategy a chance. The whole contingent of troops for the surge isn't even there yet.
You wouldn't know counterinsurgency strategy if it kept kicking and screaming out of your freaking pancreas!
That's not true.
Have you ever heard of the freaking special forces?
Yes.
Staff Sergeant Barry Sadler, Ballard of the Green Berets, does that ring a stupid freaking bell?
You're talking nonsense. I'm trying to talk strategy.
Oh, I'll talk strategy. All right. Want to talk strategy? Here's some strategy, Missy. We drop 2,000 Delta Force mothers over there and we walk away. Finito! Basta! That's all she freaking wrote! Do you understand me?
What I understand is that we either do this now or we do it 30 years from now.
You know what you sound like?
What?
You want to know what you sound like?
What?
You sound like Walt Whitman freaking Rostow, you whore!
That's
you sound like Henry freaking Kissinger, you cow! We have no freaking national interest in being in freaking Afghanistan, do you understand me?
I understand you. I disagree with you.
You don't disagree with me! You're too stupid to disagree with me! You think you disagree with me!
So you're saying let the warlords just take over again?
What do you read? Just the freaking ads in freaking Foreign Affairs?
I read the articles.
You don't read the articles! You don't even look at the pictures!
There are no pictures.
Don't change the subject. There's no freaking excuse for not having a policy of counterterrorism, except that you and your friends think it's fun to spend my money building a freaking nation out of a freaking mountain range full of freaking opium weavers and copper smokers!
You're losing the thread of the argument.
I have never lost the thread of any argument. argued about whether the Fed should end its easy money policy, I never once lost a freaking thread. You did! You even forgot Ben Bernanke's freaking name, you whore!
You said you thought we were in danger of inflation, which is absolutely untrue.
Because you say it is!
No.
Have you seen my Nexus Lexus bill? You think it hasn't gone up in the past 2 years since I've had to be informed enough to have a freaking conversation with you? Yellow me!
Do you want to get back to the subject of counterinsurgency?
It cannot work. It won't work. It never worked. It will never work. You'll work before it works, you blood-sucking sponge hole!
And I disagree.
Fine! Don't you dare hang up.
Ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Dateline New Delhi. Indian Environment Minister Jairam Ramesh has publicly apologized for the secret dumping of some 40 tons of toxic waste from the Union Carbide pesticide plant at Bhopal to an incinerator at Pitampur 2 years ago. Talking to reporters, the minister said, I admit, as minister, that it was wrong to have brought those 40 tons of waste to Bidaboor. Whatever we do needs to be done with adequate transparency. I am ready to admit publicly that transporting that waste from the Union Carbide factory secretly during the night hours was wrong. During his recent visit to the incinerating site, angry villagers greeted the environment minister and demanded immediate closure of the facility. He said the secret dumping was wrong and assured there would be an open cleanup of the site. From the You Can't Beat a Funny Name department, a member of parliament from Kent, the United Kingdom, has apologized for being drunk in the House of Commons and missing a vote on the budget. Member of Parliament Mark Reckless, absolutely, said he did not feel it was appropriate to take part in the vote in the early hours of Wednesday because of the amount he had drunk. He told BBC Radio Kent, I made a mistake. I'm really sorry about it. Reckless is one of 227 new members of Parliament who started work following the general election in May 6th. He said,
I'm terribly, terribly embarrassed. I apologize unreservedly, and I don't plan to drink again at Westminster. I shall cross the bridge to do my drinking.
No, he didn't say the last. He denied claims that he fell asleep on a terrace outside the library of Westminster, or that he got a taxi back to his constituency. He added, quote,
I remember someone asking me how to vote and not thinking it was appropriate, given how I was at the time. If I was in the sort of situation generally where I thought I was drunk, I tend to go home.
Mark Reckless, ladies and gentlemen. Dateline Marlborough, Massachusetts, a candidate in this week's special city election apologized for violating a state law regarding voter bribery. Robert Tonera, a candidate for a city council seat, sent campaign postcards to about 1,500 residents that included a coupon for ice cream, a violation of Massachusetts general laws. It was an innocent mistake, said Tonera, first-time candidate. Didn't cross my mind that I was violating any laws. Dateline Wellington, New Zealand. Television New Zealand has been ordered to broadcast an apology for a breakfast program presenter's on-air comment that British singer Susan Boyle was retarded. Presenter Paul Henry, good day, had already apologized personally for his comment in December when he laughed as he read a magazine article about how Boyle was starved of oxygen at birth and suffered an intellectual disability. Apologizing. Tom Jones has gotten an apology from the record label executive who called the singer's new album a sick joke. Jones, known for pop songs ranging from It's Not Unusual to his remake of Prince's Kiss, left EMI last year and signed with Island Records. Who owns Island now? One of the big five. It's not Island Records. It's just an imprint at a big record company. Anyway, Island thought it was going to get another album of dance songs from the 70-year-old star. Instead, Jones delivered an album of blues-flavored gospels and spirituals called Praise and Blame. This didn't sit well with Island Vice President David Sharp. He fired off an email to his colleagues that was leaked to the British media. The email read in part, Imagine my surprise when I walked into the office this morning to hear hymns coming from your office. It could have been Sunday morning. My initial pleasure came to an abrupt halt when I realized Tom Jones was singing the hymns. I've just listened to the album in its entirety and want to know if this is some sick joke. We did not invest a fortune in an established artist for him to deliver 12 tracks from the Common Book of Prayer. Jones did not take the criticism lightly, he told the Welsh paper The Western Mail. It's not coming from the creative people in the record company. The what? I mean, they're thrilled with it, so I don't understand it. People tell me all publicity is good publicity. That's what I've been told. People say to me, well, it's being talked about. But to me, it's being talked about in a negative way. According to Billboard magazine, Jones said, they've apologized. They can't apologize enough, and they've said, we'll make good on this. Uh-oh. Tom, you owe them big time. They'll make good on it. All right. After days of stony silence, Facebook has indirectly apologized to Sydney, Australia jeweler Victoria Buckley, who's been at the center of a global media frenzy after launching a battle with the site over censorship. Last week, she lashed out at Midwest American Puritanism on Facebook after it threatened action against her for having pictures of nude porcelain dolls on her fan page. They were posing with the jeweler's products. After a week of global media coverage, Facebook has apologized for censoring the images and said Buckley could re-upload the images if she wished, which she has. The British actor who played Darth Vader And the original Star Wars trilogy has been banned from attending official fan conventions. Friends of David Prowse, now 75, say he is being punished after annoying George Lucas. Prowse's website said he could not attend a forthcoming conference or any Lucasfilm-associated event. The only thing I've been told is I've burnt too many bridges between Lucasfilm and myself. Sincere apologies to all my fans who are hoping to meet with me. I shall miss you, too, says Darth Vader. Germany has apologized to fans who were denied a glimpse of their heroes when they made a low-key return home after finishing third at the World Cup. The players decided they didn't want a big reception after their semifinal loss to Spain. They landed in Frankfurt on Monday and separated to individual destinations without greeting fans. Now the team says it deeply regrets the displeasure and incomprehension caused. It said it hadn't expected fans would go to the airport and did not intend to anger them. But wait, there's more. Dateline Vancouver, British Columbia. British Columbia Mining Minister Bill Bennett apologized to Jews this week for an email calling ardent proponents of a national park eco-fascists. He opposes, does Mr. Bennett, turning a large portion of Flathead Valley into a park. He wrote, "We either stand strong together against the loss of the Flathead Valley to the eco-fascists, or we will lose the Flathead. I am there if you are there." He supports logging and other commercial uses of the valley. Said he regretted the use of what he called a very unfortunate term, laying the blame on a staff member. Also up north, Canadian Tire, has apologized for a mistake on how it supplied the controversial new Eco Fee to one of its products. A Toronto location charged 13 cents per bottle for the biodegradable and earth-friendly product Mrs. Meyer's Clean Day Shower Cleaner. The store charged customers more than it cost to recycle the product. Canadian Tire blamed a programming error. What? They didn't want this show on the air? No, computer programming. Time magazine has issued an apology for a July 2 op-ed piece by writer Joel Stein, which lampooned Indian culture in Edison, New Jersey. Quote, "We sincerely regret that any of our readers were upset by this humor column of Joel Stein's. It was in no way intended to cause offense," said the magazine. That's all we need to know about that. Head of a British, actually the Irish discount airline, Michael O'Leary, has made a full-blown apology to his rival, the founder of the European discount airline EasyJet, Sir Stelios Hadjioannou. All right, then. You're welcome. The outspoken chief executive of Europe's largest budget carrier apologized unreservedly to the other guy, with the long name, for portraying him as a Pinocchio figure in newspaper advertisements that alleged he had deliberately withheld data about EasyJet's punctuality performance. The controversy surrounding the release of the man convicted of the Lockerbie bombing reignited, as you know. Sir Nigel Sheinwald, the UK ambassador to Washington, says the new British government is clear that Megrahi's release was a mistake. It deeply regrets the continuing anguish that his release has caused the families of Megrahi's victims in the UK as well as in the US. Kind of an apology. Kinda. Republican Senator David Vitter of Louisiana has apologized to MSNBC host Rachel Maddow after jesting on a radio program that she only looked like a woman, quote, "a long time ago." "Regarding my remark during a radio conversation today, I apologize," Vitter wrote in a letter to Maddow. "The hosts made their comment and I obviously chimed in. While we do not usually agree on the issues, I do not think you deserve that comment," unquote. Vitter's comments came during an appearance on radio station in New Orleans Friday morning, during which the radio host joked about a high school photo of Maddow with long blonde hair. The NBC host currently has short brown hair. "Must have been a long time ago," Vitter joked when the host said the photo portrays Maddow as looking like a woman. Maddow has accepted his apology. ESPN officials say that analyst Rusty Wallace will not be suspended for a derogatory comment he made in reference to Kyle Busch. Wallace was heard to say "dumbass" after Bush's Victory Lane interview. Wallace issued a statement through ESPN apologizing for the remark. Apple has apologized. CEO Apple, Steve Jobs, has apologized to people who are less than satisfied with the iPhone 4, offering a free bumper. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, up and down the east coast of North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet. On the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available on your smartphone at stitcher.com. Available as a free download to members at audible.com/LeShow and available as a free podcast to everybody at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like plutonium having a shorter half-life, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Email address for this broadcast and the list of musical selections heard hereon. Just part of the festival of online treats at harryshearer.com. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks as always to Pam Halstead. And Le Show is on Twitter at LeTwits. Join the thousands. Special treats provided for those of you who join. And it's free. And it's kind of fun. I'm going to go hire Ray Nagin as my disaster response advisor now. See you next week. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.